Hello.
Hi, everyone. We're going to get started now. We've hit 2:30. First of all, just wanted to say a big thank you for joining us this afternoon. It's really, really great to have you all here. So we're going to be spending the next hour talking about the emerging science around longevity and health spans as well. I just wanted to say a little bit about why we wanted to bring this conversation to South By. First of all, as we'll talk about, this is an incredibly exciting area of science, really interesting applications in terms of patient care. And so there's a whole ton there as well around, you know, thinking of longevity in terms of a vehicle for investment, vertical for investment as well. But to be frank, the other reason that we really wanted to have this conversation is because this is an issue that's going to affect all of us, right? Whether we are kind of slowly getting ourselves to the point where we might require increased healthcare or caring for elderly parents, this whole conversation around giving ourselves better insight into our personal health and using that to extend our lifespans and our health spans is going to be, you know, incredibly relevant to each of us as we get into the next couple of decades. So just to give you guys a bit of a roadmap for what we're going to do over the next hour, we will start to get into some of the most exciting areas of innovation that we see coming through the pipeline, cover senolytics, wearables, efforts to better understand our biological age as well as our chronological age. And we will talk a little bit as well about the bottlenecks and what is preventing this kind of vision for a new version of healthcare from becoming a reality and what we can do to start to unpick some of those. So for anyone who hasn't already, we've got Mentimeter that we're going to use throughout the session. Really just want to use this to gauge some of your insights, some of your perspectives as we go. So if you wouldn't mind either scanning the QR code, which will take you through to the Menti site, or otherwise go to the website and pop the code in. And we will be asking you guys for input, some questions that where we specifically want your take. But also through the system, you'll be able to enter any questions that you have throughout the whole process, and we'll reserve kind of 10 minutes at the end to talk through some of those and put those to the panel as well. So with that, I'm going to introduce our brilliant panel. So I'm going to start from the far end. Lucy Gwill is a director on the Oracle Health Innovation Team, which works to bring human-centric innovation across the health sector. Before joining Oracle, Lucy worked across communicable disease surveillance and direct-to-employer health services. Lucy is also a certified integrative health coach specializing in behavior change for healthcare. So a really, really interesting background for us to dive into. Next up, Martin Carkett, science and innovation policy lead at the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change, where his work focuses on health and technology. Martin previously worked in the UK government in the Treasury Department and holds a PhD in stem cell and developmental biology. And last but not least, we have Ben Rolnick. So after a career in Hollywood talent management, Ben now is the director of the Stanford Healthcare Innovation Lab, where his work focuses on research and development of precision medicine technologies, which is, again, incredibly relevant to our conversation today. So just before I come to the panel with first questions, we wanted to put a couple of questions to you to kick us off. So first of all, if we can ask you in one word to describe how you feel about your country's current healthcare system. I'm going to give you full liberty, anything you want to give us on
great.
This.
That's great.
Okay. We're getting a theme here.
Racket.
Okay.
Not many expletives.
Yeah. Where's amazing?
Great service. Okay, we'll give it a couple more seconds.
Meh.
Yeah, awful. Risk averse. Okay, great. We can keep those coming in for the next
Criminal.
Couple of minutes.
Interesting.
Yeah. And we're going to ask you guys to give us your view on another question as well, which is the extent to which you'd be willing to share your personal health data with health professionals, Department for Health, academic researchers.
Wow, it's great watching this in real time.
Yeah.
It's cool.
It's actually much more positive than I thought it would be.
Anonymized.
Yeah. Okay, this is great. So we're actually going to put a pin in this and come back to this at the end of the session and see if anyone's views have changed, but it's really helpful just to get a sense of where everybody is starting from. So with that, I'm going to turn to our panel. You guys are all working at the intersection of healthcare and technology. Can you say a little bit about why you focus on the work that you do, what brought you to this area? Mm-hmm. And Lucy, let's start with you.
Sure. So I'm going to go back to the title of the panel, Extending Lifespan and Health Span. And I think unless you work in this area, I don't know that people are sitting around talking, you know, at the dinner table about these two terms, and certainly not about the difference between them. And so lifespan is the number of years you live, but health span is the number of years you spend in good health. And in the U.S. and around the world, lifespan has been steadily increasing. So if you look in the U.S., over about the last 50 years, we've gone from a life expectancy of 70 years to 79 years. So that's almost 10 extra years of life for us as individuals and for our society. But health span has not been increasing at the same rate. And so I think that really we're living longer, but we're not living healthier. We're plagued by chronic diseases typically associated with aging, like heart disease, cancer, and dementia. So one of the reasons that I think we're all up here is because now that we've got lifespan on this trajectory, good trajectory, I think we need to pay as equal attention and put as much investment in lifespan, in health span as we have in lifespan. And really, that's the challenge for industry and academia and governments to leverage the technology and the data that we now have access to continue to increase health span so that people can actually enjoy the extra years that we've given them and in whatever way is the most meaningful for them, you know, contributing to their communities and their families, continuing to learn and continuing to have decision-making capacity to the end of their lives.
Great. Thanks, Lucy. Martin, I'm going to come to you and then Ben.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, for me, I think, you know, human life is the most precious thing we have, right? And being able to work on developing policies that are aiming to either extend the quantity of that or quality of that is one of the most purposeful things that I think you can do, really. And, you know, it's not just from a kind of that sort of personal perspective, but also from a societal perspective as well, because as Lucy was alluding to there, you know, we're living longer, but not necessarily healthier. And so there's this extended period of life where we're actually living in poor health. And that's putting enormous burdens on healthcare systems and, incidentally, pension systems as well. Of our societies and our economies, and it's just, you know, not sustainable. In the UK at the moment, I think about 40% of all public expenditure is now going on healthcare through the NHS, and that's doubled in the last 20 years or so, and is probably going to continue to go on that trajectory. And we just, you know, we can't afford not to tackle this problem. So it's not nice to have, you know, good health spans. It's actually a challenge for our generation that we've got to tackle at a very fundamental level. And so that's why at the Tony Blair Institute we're trying to work with governments around the world to develop policies that can radically bring improvements to health spans and lifespans. And that's why we're working on it.
Great. Thanks, Martin. Ben?
Yeah, so to piggyback off what Martin was saying, I think that healthcare and health is our most valuable asset. If you think about it, what's more valuable than your health? There's the proverb that says that, you know, the man with health has many dreams, but the man without health has but one. And ultimately, at the end of the day, if we don't protect our health, then we don't get to keep it. And I spent the beginning part of my career in the entertainment business seeing some of the most rich and famous people in the world miserably depressed and unhappy and sick. And at the end of the day, a lot of these people would have traded everything just to feel happy, just to feel healthy, and to live a good life. So at the end of the day, I think that's what draws me to this in a deep way, is understanding not just the pathology around health, so understanding disease, injury, things like that, but also vitality, health optimization, things that help us live our best life ever. And, you know, in relationship to the topic today, it's interesting because thousands of years ago, the Buddha said, we get old, we get sick, and we die. And originally the prescription for that was, well, let's, you know, practice mindfulness and practices that help us kind of overcome the material in the body. But in the 21st century, we have amazing access to tools and technologies that are just being developed to stave off aging, sickness, even death in some cases. So it's a very exciting time to be a part of this. And it's also personal. It's my health. It's my family's health. It's my, you know, future daughter's health.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I mean, it's really interesting, this area. And I feel like there's been so much buzz about it, particularly in the last few months with the launch of Altos Labs. I mean, one of the questions that I hear talked about a lot is, you know, how realistic is it for longevity therapies to come to market? Or is this still some way off? Is it blue sky thinking? Martin, I don't know, maybe we'll come to you first if you have a view on that.
Yeah, sure. So longevity research in particular, and the sort of things that Altos Labs are trying to do is almost kind of a health hack, really. What they're trying to do is, rather than tackle, you know, various chronic diseases in isolation, they're trying to tackle the fundamental root causes of aging, which in turn, you know, contributes to disease. And they're trying to do that by finding out the molecular biological causes of aging, with the hope that if they can find those and understand those, then we can find molecular targets that we can develop drugs to use against them, and ultimately slow down the aging process altogether, and then delay the onset of chronic illnesses such as your cancers and dementia and heart diseases. Now, this theory, which is, you know, it's been around for years really, but it's always been kind of quite a fanciful thought, and it's always been kind of sidelined by the academic community up until about 10 or so years ago. And what you're finding now is that there's some, you know, really grounded, genuine science starting to emerge that is actually beginning to unpick the molecular pathways that are involved in aging at a very holistic level. And already they're starting to develop drugs to manipulate those processes and slow them down. And so, Jess, you mentioned earlier senolytics. So this is one category of drugs that have been developed. So you might have heard of rapamycin and metformin. And these are drugs that target particular pathways that are associated with aging. And at the moment, they've, you know, been shown to be quite promising in animal models and in preclinical trials. So, you know, what was completely unrealistic, you know, 10 or 20 years ago is actually now becoming more and more realistic. And it's great to see someone like Altos, you know, putting so much money behind it. You know, that's real money that's going to really drive progress in the coming years. And it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, the topic of this conversation is 2050, right? By 2050, mm-hmm. there's actually drugs on the market that, you know, all of us in this room can take to slow down our aging and maybe improve our health spans.
Great.
Probably, you know, sooner than that for a lot of really interesting therapies. But, you know, just to kind of piggyback on what you're saying, as a Silicon Valley guy in the room, there's high-tech solutions and then there's low-tech solutions. And I think that at the end of the day, longevity at its base level is just about not dying. And when you think about all of the innovations that have occurred over the last 100 or 200 years that save lives, you know, you can think about everything from, I think it was like the 1877 town gas to natural gas transformation that Malcolm Gladwell talks about in his new book, Talking to Strangers, which reduced, you know, kind of like accidental deaths and suicides and things like that, you know, to some of these kind of more advanced, you know, uses of whole body MRI, for example, which QBio is doing to detect stage one pancreatic cancers, which should be a medical impossibility, but it's actually not really that complicated when you look at it. It's just a radically different approach. And that's not futuristic. That's really simple. It's just identifying the disease at an earlier stage so that you're not, for example, diagnosing a cancer in stage 3 and 4, in which case you need some of these highly futuristic types of interventions to treat it, but instead catching it at a stage 1, which, you know, might require something a little bit less futuristic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Lucy, did you want to comment on this one?
I'll quickly add that what scientific, technological breakthrough hasn't been considered impossible at some point, you know?
Yeah.
And, I mean, think about 3D printing replacement body parts. Like, we can already do that. We're already printing, you know, middle ear bones and transplanting them in humans. And while we're not doing 3D organ transplants yet, that's not that far off. And so, you know, the impossible is possible, especially now that it's really powered by the data and the technology that we have to achieve it.
Can I add to so just to add to that, so there was something that you said earlier, and it reminded me, I think that the BMJ published a paper in 2017 showing that actually life expectancy in the U.S. had been declining over the past few years. And if you look at that, one of the reasons is due to, you know, the rate, the increasing rate of suicides and, you know, drug overdoses and things along those lines. And I think it's really fascinating to think about, you know, again, all the causes of, you know, death, disease, injury, illness. But another thing to kind of consider here, too, is that, you know, the Baltimore Longitudinal Study of Aging essentially found that, you know, aging and disease are not, aging doesn't necessarily cause disease, but disease does accelerate aging. So part of this is also really about identifying disease in new ways. And, you know, then to Martin's point, around what you can do with stem cells today, if you guys want to check out the work of a guy named Juan Carlos Bustamante, it's pretty amazing where he's literally, you know, taking cells and bringing them back to a pluripotent place, or even converting, you know, for example, you know, skin cells to brain cells. It's pretty incredible stuff.
It's amazing what they can do on that front these days. Like, they can do some of that in vivo where, you know, in a living person in situ, start injecting, you know, either stem cells in there or reprogramming cells through, you know, delivery of mRNA or other gene therapies to, you know, start reversing them back to stem cells.
Yeah. Have you heard this concept of like the longevity escape velocity?
Something like that.
Yeah. I don't know if that's the exact expression, but it's the idea, if you can live long enough, you know, beyond a certain time, I think it might be 20, 50, something like that, that you have the potential to live forever. So just don't get, like, don't fall down, don't get hit by a car right now.
Keep yourself
going. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, I think it's this really interesting question as well of, like, how long do people really want to live for? And so often I feel like when you have this conversation, people are like, I don't want to live till 200 because I know that I'm going to spend the second century in ill health. And actually what we're talking about now is the potential that you'd be able to live potentially that long, but with the decent health of a 40-year-old. Actually, we'd love your view on this as well. I think we've got another Mentimeter question. So how long would you choose to live if you were in good health? And I think this question's fascinating because there's all of the conversations around what do you do with that extra time if you do live for longer, right? We've optimized a life where you are educated and grow, you work, and then you retire and, you know, are looked after, and that could completely change. Okay, so we've got quite a lot of you wanting to live forever. Like it.
Yeah. I wonder what the confounding variables for this question are.
We were actually talking about this last night in the bar, and we were like, imagine if you had lived 300 years. If you'd lived the last 300 years, you would have come out at the back of the French Revolution and through the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a term I really like that I learned recently is the longevity dividend, and I might look to my fellow panelists to define it. But, you know, people at this stage in life have so much to contribute if they're healthy enough to do so. So much wisdom. They're not necessarily still focused on making money. And so I see articles like people in their 80s or even 90s teaching English for free because they don't need the money anymore. They just want to help other people. And so I think it's really, I love that longevity dividend, and I wonder, does anybody want to take a go at the actual definition?
I don't know the actual definition, but I mean, it's basically what you've described there. That, I mean, if we can improve people's health span so that they can, you know, continue to contribute to the economy for a longer time, and, you know, you maybe do a second career later in your life, in your third age or whatever, and, you know, and I think, you know, it's something, and we're going slightly off topic here, but I mean, it's something that governments are also going to have to think about, because at the moment all the, you know, economic policies and stimulus are targeted at young people, and actually populations are aging, and we need to start thinking about economic policies for the older generation.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to see what happens in the next couple of decades.
So I think that's a really interesting point. One of the things that keeps coming up as well in these conversations is around lifestyle changes, right? I mean, we started to talk about some of the really interesting areas of tech, but we know that there are things that people can and probably should do to preserve their health. Often many of us don't do it, but I mean, Ben, maybe I'll come to you first. Like, how would you think about this in terms of preventative and lifestyle change?
Yeah, so I think that the first question to start with there is, do any of you know what the number one predictor of health is? Interesting. Okay. Well, this one comes from what?
Did you say friends?
Yeah. So this finding actually comes from, I think, a study that started in 1938 at Harvard called the Harvard Study of Adult Development. And essentially what they found is that more than IQ, socioeconomic status, DNA, education, things like that, actually the quality of your close relationships is more determinative of your physical health than your cholesterol levels. That's really interesting stuff, you know. And I think that the number one thing that you can do is you know, obviously improve close relationships, live a happy life, be grateful, et cetera. But then that begs big questions around how do you do that? And it's actually really interesting. We just published in the last week a randomized controlled trial that we did on an intervention called Date with Destiny. That's a 6-day immersive course. And essentially what we found was that 100% of the experimental group were in remission from depression after a 6-day intervention, basically 6 weeks later. And as far as like drops in anxiety and drops in depression, they far, far, far outperformed the control group as well as anything that we've seen published in the psychiatric literature, even, you know, psychedelic trials like psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy, where, you know, you really only see 50 to 58% of participants in remission after, you know, 1 to 4 week treatment. So I would say that you're also going to see, and I think that this is another really important part, really a focus, just to go back to this for a second, right? So it begs big questions, like why would somebody not want to live forever or 200 years? And what I believe about that is inherent in that question is an idea, is the question around quality of life and the question around how much are you enjoying your life? How much vivacity do you have? And there's a term for this called salutogenics or salutogenic medicine. And it's something that I've been very passionate about for years, because if you think about it, like, here's your baseline. Most medicine is just focusing on the stuff below versus the stuff above, which is around happiness, well-being, longevity, et cetera. So I think we're going to see a lot more breakthroughs in that area over the next few decades to try to probably make up for, you know, the extensions and longevity. But it's at good timing.
Lucy, I know you've done a whole ton of work around behavioral change as well. Do you want to pitch in?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all need to be seeing Ben instead of because if most of us, if we go in for and we're looking for, you know, information on how to improve our health, we're reading about diet and exercise, and we all know that we need to do that. And some of us feel guilty that we're not doing it. And why aren't we doing it? I mean, we know it improves health, but over half of Americans have a poor diet, and almost half aren't exercising enough. So what's the problem there? And yes, there are socioeconomic factors at play. I mean, especially in regard to access to healthy food and education. But one of the primary reasons that we're not doing this is because behavior change is so hard. And, you know, not just because it's hard to fit into your daily life or because of cultural or social pressures, but because of the neural pathways that we form in our brain based on years of doing things the same way. And so I think, you know, we all kind of know what we need to do to improve our health and where we should really be focusing our time on supporting the methodologies and the technologies that are facilitating behavior change. So one area that I'm really passionate about is a kind of a newly emerged field of health coaching. And health coaches are trained in techniques and communication methods to help people develop intrinsic motivation to change. So let's say someone comes to a health coach because their doctor has told them that they have high cholesterol and they're at such and such risk of having a heart attack or a stroke. You know, they're coming from a place of fear and kind of confusion and very abstract concepts, trying to understand these lab results and the probabilities that they're going to get ill. And that doesn't really inspire change. And so what health coaching can do is help patients walk through what actually inspires you. What do you want to live for? And with a lot of the clients I worked with, they were typically women ages 50 to 70. And so we would start to think about, okay, what do you want to be? What do you want to use your health for? And they would say, always, I want to be, first of all, alive, and then I want to be healthy enough to enjoy the moments with my family. I want to be there for weddings. I want to be there for my children, my grandchildren. And so once you start to reframe what you want your health for, and then also start to set tangible sort of small step goals, that kind of change is much more doable. And I'm really excited about, and I won't go into this too much, but I'm really excited about how machine learning can play in this area, because a lot of the techniques that are used in health coaching are actually quite programmatic. So I think that machines can be taught to help people who don't necessarily have regular access to coaches, you know, through telemedicine or in person.
But by the way, to piggyback on that, there's a startup that I'm really passionate about called Heal Communities that was founded by a functional medicine community leader. And they're essentially getting Medicare to cover health coaching as like an add-on to, you know, kind of primary care and clinical practices.
Yes. So this is
very cool.
It's unbelievable that it wasn't covered until just last year. And then even nutrition, you know, counseling wasn't covered really until kind of recently. So we're making big steps, but there's still a ways to go, you know, to convert from intervention to prevention.
Oh, and the data is extremely promising.
Yeah.
I mean, this stuff is working very effectively.
Yes. Yeah. It's really fascinating. Just hearing you talk, remind me, there's a psychologist who I think is retired now, who is at Harvard, a guy called Bob Keegan, who did some really interesting work on this, going to a population who were asked to take one single drug every day for the rest of their lives to try and prevent heart failure. And after a year, I think it was something like 55% of them weren't taking this single pill.
Yeah.
And
adherence.
And it was all behavioral and it was all psychological and actually really helping them get to the core of, I know this is good for me, but I'm not doing it. And why not?
Because it's not important to me because I haven't connected it to what is important.
Exactly. You can't see the tangible result.
It's fascinating. I mean, one of the areas that I think might play into this as well is, what happens if you have more information about your own personalized health so that then you can make better decisions as well? So you have that extra information alongside the kind of health coaching to try and force you to make better choices about your personal health. Actually, one of the questions that we'd love to get everyone's input on is this, which is just how much insight do you have about your personal health right now? And this might differ across geographies as well, but we'd just love to get a sense of how much insight you have right now. Okay. So a decent mix. That's interesting. Okay.
Huh.
I mean, one of the things that I'd love for us to have a bit of a conversation about as well is wearables, linking very much to this, because I imagine those of you who do have good insight, it's probably because you've got a decent number of trackers that you use for different parts of your life. I mean, Ben, I know this is something that you've done a ton of work on at Stanford.
Yeah. So there's a great Drucker, Peter Drucker, saying that you can't manage what you can't measure. And at the end of the day, if we think about what healthcare fundamentally boils down to, it's data. You go into your clinician's office and clinical labs are taken, you know, you get your vitals taken, et cetera. And that information, that data is used to inform treatment planning and diagnostics and, you know, just really your care path and even your health trajectory. But at the end of the day, there are big questions around the value, the quality, and the use of that data that's currently being generated. Like, for example, can somebody in the audience tell me what is a healthy temperature?
38. 37. 97.7. 98.
37. Yeah.
Isn't there a range?
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is great, because the thing is that the party line is that it's 37 Celsius and then 98.6 Fahrenheit. But at the end of the day, that number was actually based on an 1851 study, I think in like Austria, something like that. And a meta-analysis published in 2002 showed that the actual real median temperature is closer to 97.5. And, you know, to some of you, that's shocking, but there's a huge interquartile range all the way up to like 94.6 to 99.1. And so when we look at something that's supposed to be as simple and as useful as temperature, and has been one of the primary screening mechanisms, by the way, of COVID, and you understand that an individual could be walking around with a 95 degree baseline temperature, walking into a place, you know, getting their temporal temperature taken at 98.6, and that represents, you know, a 3-4 degree, you know, temperature increase, that we can almost guarantee is indicative of an infection or something going on or going wrong. And so when we think about, you know, kind of like data, that's sort of one of the big missions of our lab, is to revolutionize the use of big data to advance healthcare. And we measure everything, like everything that we can get our hands on, even the molecules in the air around individuals. But wearable devices, I think, are one of the most overlooked but important health instruments in the world today. I mean, they're worn by millions of people around the world. They take hundreds of thousands of measurements. And if you had asked anyone 10 years ago, they would have said that these are just toy fitness trackers, because there's a major distinction around absolute quantification. So that's the ability for, you know, this device to take the same reading over time and converge with other instruments, versus relative quantification, which is the ability for this device to give me an accurate reading relative to itself over time. And that measures fundamentally me, my baseline. And if you take a personalized medicine approach, what we know is that I look more like me, ill and healthy, than I look like anyone else. But the way that healthcare works today is not based on personalization. It's based on these population averages, like 37 degrees Celsius, 98.6, and you either fit to that threshold or you don't. But that's not the way that it should be, and that's not the way that it's going to be in the future. So we've done a lot of work with wearable devices, most recently, you know, published a few times over the past year, but in Nature Medicine in last December, around detecting COVID-19 presymptomatically in individuals using smartwatches. You know, about 80% of the time, median 3 days before first reported symptoms. And if you think about the power of something like that, with the amount of people wearing these devices and what else they're going to be able to do, it's just staggering and exciting. So, yeah, I'll stop there.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely amazing. I mean, if that had been in place at the beginning of the pandemic, then...
And by the way, what about for the next one?
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Where
exactly,
we don't have all the strains, you know, figured out, and the ability to test for it.
Probably avoid a lot of the really hard lockdowns.
Yeah, absolutely. So just wanted to very briefly pause and say, please do keep your questions coming in. We will get to them in about 10 minutes or so. For those who've just joined, you're able to submit them on Mentimeter, and we'll take those and round them up at the end. But one of the things that I just wanted to pause us on here is this question around our genetics as well, right? Because our genetic makeup makes such a difference in terms of, you know, our predisposition to a whole ton of illnesses and diseases. And Martin, I know you've worked on this as well. Do you want to say a little bit just about how you're seeing breakthroughs in genomics?
Yeah, as well? Sure. So I think genomics is the other big piece of the puzzle in personalized medicine that we haven't talked about yet. And, you know, as you just said there, Jess, you know, the genes we inherit are unique to us, but can also greatly increase or reduce the risk of certain diseases. And if we can understand what our genetic profile is in the context of, you know, our lifestyles and the environments we live in as well, it's not solely genetic, then, you know, we can understand what diseases we're more predisposed to from the get-go, and then we can take action to either, you know, try and prevent that or try and treat that from very early on. So it comes back to this point that Ben was talking about earlier about trying to make healthcare more upstream, right, more preventative, about managing and optimizing your health that is, you know, the genetic lottery that you've inherited, to live the best possible life you can, rather than wait to get sick and then try and treat the the disease when it comes. And the other great thing about genomics is it's become a lot cheaper and a lot, you know, a lot quicker, right? A lot. I mean, if you think about the Human Genome Project, which completed in, what, 2003? And it took about 13 or 14 years to sequence one entire human genome at the cost of, I don't know, multiple billions of dollars. Well, now we can sequence an entire human genome in just 5 or 6 hours with the latest, you know, third-gen sequencing technologies. And we can do that at a cost of about $1,000 per genome. So, you know, that's still, you know, not dirt cheap, but it's a hell of a lot cheaper than it was. And I think in the next, you know, decade or so, this will become a completely routine part of healthcare, where, you know, probably at birth, we all have our genome sequenced right from the beginning. And, you know, we know from the beginning of our lives what we're in for, really, and what we can manage.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And I think there's a couple of things that come out of that. One is, you know, if we have widespread sequencing, first of all, how do you manage that data? And number two, how do you use it and then translate it into better clinical outcomes as well?
Yeah, well, that's a really good point. So the $1,000 is just to sequence it, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But actually, the real cost is analyzing the data. Yeah. And, you know, okay, the advances in artificial intelligence and stuff will make that cheaper as well in time. But, I mean, if you're talking about trying to do this across an entire population, that's actually, you know, quite a big cost.
Yeah. By the way, just to put that into context, so a lab like ours will gather petabytes of data on an individual. And if you think about just the storage cost of a petabyte of data, it's about $20,000 per month for one individual. Mm-hmm. Now imagine that at scale for millions of people. We're not quite there yet.
Yeah, Lucy, I know obviously this is a big focus for Oracle Health as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, before we could really even talk about the potential of artificial intelligence and machine learning, I think we really need to go back and look at the other noteworthy advances that we've seen in sort of data generation and the ability to manage it. Mm-hmm. Thinking about electronic health records and digitizing images and the wearable data that we've talked about, the remote monitoring data that's really only going to increase in volume with 5G. And then once you add in sequencing data natural language processing data, optical character recognition, I mean, you were talking about, like you said, tons of data. And so now that we've got the ability to generate all this data, what are we going to do with it? Because it's really not useful in isolation. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where the next shift is really happening. And how are we going to manage and architect the data to enable us to leverage AI in healthcare? And that's where advances like cloud computing and data lakes and now data lakehouses are really going to allow us to do this. Bring together data that we were never able to compare before, you know, unstructured data, structured data, apples and oranges, if you will. And so now we'll be able to clean and organize it in a way that we can not just compare it to each other, but also use it as a whole data set. And then do that in an environment that enables high-performance computing and machine learning and in a way that's accessible and cheaper and faster. And so ultimately we can achieve the kind of scale that we need to see the change that we want. And there are a couple really examples that I really like, if I have time to give a couple. One is a partnership between Oracle, the University of Oxford, and the Tony Blair Institute around the Global Pathogen Analysis System, or GPAS. And this is a system that really catapulted the ability to share sequencing data across the entire world and to be able to track the progression of COVID variants so that researchers and public health officials could make informed decisions to really start to prevent the spread of variants of concern. And then another sort of more personal example and on an individual level is around diabetes. So I think about for diabetic patients, the one of the largest risk factors for morbidity and mortality is uncontrolled blood sugar. And in the life of someone with diabetes, you know, typically up until recently, you're pricking your finger, you're testing your blood glucose, you're trying to determine how much insulin to administer. And I don't know this I think many of us know people who are doing this on a daily basis or had to mm-hmm. Until recently. But thanks to the power of technology and the machine learning models that we've been teaching with glucose readings before and after administration of insulin, people are now able to continuously monitor their blood sugar and then use an automatic administration of insulin. So they're not having to do anything. So not only is that improving their lives and kind of giving them back their lives, but also preventing the chance that something is going to go wrong with their blood sugar.
Also, just to jump in here really quickly, because we're up here with Oracle, and I just want to illustrate to you guys how profound and amazing the cloud is. So when was the last time you guys used a fax machine? Who here has used a fax machine recently? Okay, you must be in healthcare. she's nodding yes. And you think about that, and you kind of scratch your head where healthcare is still the largest buyers of fax machines. We're on to iPhones these days.
The NHS in England is the biggest buyer of fax machines in the world.
It's scary. So you start to imagine that, you know, previously healthcare has been a system that everything has been, you know, documents, paper, filed away and isolated. And now we're entering into an era where that data, that information can be shared, it can be accessed, it can be aggregated. And that's just so amazing. I mean,
yeah, I think we were laughing yesterday because thinking of the example of providers and researchers still use lab notebooks. And not only that, they're writing notes on napkins and taping them into the notebooks. And I'm not saying that OCR can read all of that, but there's a possibility to integrate all of that into the data that we are now able to analyze. So the potential is really exciting.
So I'm going to be a bit of a downer here and say, you know, we've talked a lot about the opportunity and how exciting the future is. What's preventing us from getting there? Like, we have so much capability. Where are the barriers? Ben, maybe I'll come to you first.
So I would, you know, I thought a lot about that yesterday. Yeah. You hit me with that question yesterday, and I was thinking to myself, like, wow, that's a big, heavy question. But I really would say that to me, it's about information asymmetry. And at the end of the day, I mean, if you just look at the world of media, there's so much misinformation, and there's so many siloed areas of information, and nobody really can reach a consensus around what's true, what's right, what's good. And healthcare is no different. I mean, you know, there are thousands of biomedical journal articles that are published every day. How are you supposed to keep up with that? You know, there's not a centralized system that says, hey, look, here are all of the cutting edge breakthroughs. This is what you should be doing. Let's go. It's more like physicians are practicing things that they learned in medical school. They're practicing based on best practices, and that evolves over time. But there really is a deep asymmetry of the information. So if you want novel breakthroughs in regenerative medicine, those might be out there. They might be possible for you. In fact, you might even be eligible for a clinical trial for a disease that could save your life. But how do you get access to that information?
Yeah.
Lucy,
I was thinking along similar lines. You know, how are we going to integrate these incredible insights into our existing systems and workflows? And going back to the physician example, you know, especially after COVID, we're looking at scarcity issues, complete burnout. Physicians only spend, you know, a number of minutes with patients, and then probably spend way more time than they want to with systems that weren't designed with them as the user in mind, or really designed with the patient in mind. They were designed for other purposes. And so I think we need to make existing systems and new things that we're building really human-centric and focused on all of the users within the ecosystem of healthcare. So not just the patients, not just the providers, but also the, you know, the public health officials and the researchers who need to use this information.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Martin, we at the Tony Blair Institute obviously do a lot of work with governments, and we've worked previously on some of these issues around longevity. How do you think about the role that governments should be playing, governments around the world should be playing in trying to unlock some of this opportunity?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'll speak to longevity, but also healthcare more generally. I think, you know, there's a couple of things that I think governments ought to be thinking about. And the first is just It's just funding, right? It's just paying for it, right? We've got all these technologies that we've described throughout this talk here in existence, and we can build this tech stack that if we you know, use it in a comprehensive way, can really radically change healthcare. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, we're using these technologies in bit part and, you know, a bit here and a bit there, but not in a really coordinated and sort of comprehensive way. And that's partly because, you know, the election cycles are so small, right? It's so short. And so, yeah, and so, you know, we're not going to fix this overnight, but you know what I mean? This is going to take a lot of money up front, a lot of capital up front. But the economic benefits that will, you know, be delivered through having a healthier population over time will be orders of magnitude more. But you've got to have really long-term strategic funding from the beginning. So that's number one. Number two, I think, is not just making use of the technologies that exist today, but also thinking about technologies that are in the pipeline, that are on the horizon, or things that we don't even know about, right? And yeah, creating the right ecosystems and fostering innovation across both the public and private sector. So funding, you know, basic research through public money, yeah, but also creating the right sort of, you know, tax and spending incentives to push the private sector to incentivize innovation, and not just develop new technologies, but take the technologies that exist today and make them cheaper and better and faster. Yeah. And, you know, we were talking about some of these things that exist, but they're basically not usable in a population wide level because they're too expensive at the moment. So we need to innovate and continue to innovate to push forward progress. And then thirdly, I think, you know, actually it's not all on governments, right? I mean, a lot of this is down to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think one job of the government is to actually push responsibility back to the citizen and the individual and say, look, you've got to start taking responsibility for your own health more so than you are at the moment. And again, we have these technologies at our disposal to help us do that. And we know what lifestyle changes we've got to make. But they can put structures around that to help people to do that. So I think they're the three things that I would focus on.
Great. To-do list for governments. I love it.
Yeah.
So we've actually got a ton of questions that have come in. So I'm going to go to these and see if I can show question. Hopefully that'll show up there. So somebody is trying to make a career change, clearly. But this question, what skills do I need and how should I start preparing for a future career in health tech? Ben, I mean, I guess you see a pipeline of incredibly smart people coming into this space. What's your sense of
two words, data science and specifically bioinformatics. Our lab has placed a very, very strong emphasis right now on training the next generation of computer scientists and data scientists to handle biomedical big data. Because one of the big problems that you kind of have to imagine, especially if you're not really familiar with this space, is that, you know, say you get a cancer diagnosis, you know, God forbid, and you're trying to figure out what to do with that. Well, there are so many amazing diagnostic technologies that are out there, but the challenge is, who's going to analyze and interpret that data? Who's going to even request those tests to be done? This is the next frontier, and the problem is, to the UI UX points that you guys made earlier, and even the computation ML points, none of this stuff right now is one click easy. You know, it's all like dirty, gross wires and, you know, like hard hacking computers back in the day with really unsexy user interfaces. And you have to understand real programming in order to deal with this. Eventually, in 15, 20 years, you could just sort of press a button and the tools will be automated. But I would say that if you're interested in this area in the future of healthcare, really dive deep into data science, and, you know, you can even come talk to me afterwards and I can point you in the right directions.
Awesome. Thanks, Ben. We've got a question here, which, Martin, I think we'll probably bring to you, which is around, in what ways, if any, is the NHS ahead of the US with regards to personalized healthcare?
That's a good question. I actually don't know too much about the American healthcare system, to be honest, in that sort of level of detail. Where is the NHS? I mean, we're getting there, but kind of slowly. So, I mean, we still don't even really have complete electronic health records across, you know, all of our NHS trusts. So NHS trusts are basically the organizations that run hospitals and maybe run a series of hospitals in a particular region. And that's, you know, really the first step in understanding personalized, you know, health, actually having a complete record on a digital platform that shows you what your health has been historically. But we are getting better. And one thing to point out, actually, that is been really encouraging is the UK Biobank. So this was a public-private sort of partnership that was established in the UK through Genomics England that's taken, I think it's now got over 1 million participants that have agreed to sign up and actually have their genome sequenced. And they're using that to find all sorts of information about those individuals, but also at a population level as well, about, you know, what are the genetic traits that lie behind certain rare diseases that are difficult otherwise to identify if you don't have that massive kind of large data set. But obviously, in terms of, you know, the individuals involved in that, their personal health is much better understood than, you know, the rest of the population. And I know they're expanding that to 5 million, I think, in the next 5 years. So right. We're definitely moving in that direction where we want to become, you know, much more further down the line of personalized medicine. I think it's getting there. The US, I think, is probably a little bit behind, but it's obviously a bigger country with harder logistics and more complications in the sort of public-private split of healthcare responsibilities.
Great. So we've got a really interesting question that's come in. It says, I've been waiting for the right time to get a full gene sequencing. Mm-hmm. Is it the time to do that yet? And is there a partial sequencing you'd recommend for health management reasons today? Does anybody want to take that one?
I'll have one go. It's a bit like, when's the best time to plant a tree, right? The answer is 20 years ago, but the next best time is today. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we've discussed in this talk that it's gotten a lot cheaper, and I guess it really comes down to affordability, right? It's only going to get cheaper as advances are continued to made. But if you can afford to do it now, then I would do it today.
I'll just add that while the actual sequencing may be cheaper and accessible now, you know, taking those insights that you gain and turning them into digestible and actionable insights is more of the challenge right now for all of us, for providers and for patients. So I think we'll make progress in that area, I hope, soon.
We have these bespoke things. So as the question references, right, the partial sequencing where, you know, you use 23andMe or other such companies that, you know, will take, you know, readings of sort of SNPs and, oh, there's somebody shaking their head there.
Sequence the whole chromosome.
No.
Sequence a part of it.
Yeah.
Pass it off as if they sequence the whole
chromosome. Yeah.
Your genetic data that you get back is very small.
Yeah.
Marketed in a way that is not really telling you that you're only getting like a snapshot. Like you throw a dart at a target and you're getting that much of the target.
It would be a fraction of the genome, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still better than nothing, but...
But what does that really tell you in relation to everything else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's... I mean, I work in gene sequencing and all of that, so that's why I kind of...
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I think they only look at protein coding regions as well, right? Which what accounts for 1% of the genome. So, and not even entire regions. So, yeah, it's going to be very small data in incomplete context. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to bring in. Sorry, Ben. Did you want to?
There's a lot that I could say on that. Yeah. I mean.
Okay. Well, maybe save that for afterwards. There's a really great question here around, doesn't insurance-based healthcare counter the willingness to share health data? And one of the areas we didn't talk about was how our health systems need to change to take account of all of the developments that we've talked about. So, Ben, did you want to comment on that one?
I got into an amazing debate with somebody yesterday about that. And you know, one of the greatest fears around sharing healthcare data is the prospect of, you know, health discrimination. And I think that's a really pessimistic view. I mean, it's maybe realistic, but it's also pessimistic. And alternatively, what we can also understand is that sharing healthcare data, especially with the right teams, the right folks, will lead towards pronounced medical breakthroughs so that you'll stay healthy, you won't get sick. If you do get sick, you're going to get a better treatment, the right time, the first time, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there are for sure these doomsday scenarios, but it's a little odd to me, especially as a millennial, what some of our fears around sharing healthcare data are about. You know, it's definitely something that, you know, we can form a little circle at, you know, around at the end and just like express our grievances and our thoughts. I don't necessarily want to take an official stand on that. I just believe that if more data was available to researchers, it would totally transform the world of healthcare.
Yeah, I'll just add that, you know, we're doing all of our banking online. I mean, we're doing all of our shopping online, but we're still just not quite comfortable with sharing all of our health data. And I think it really depends on the type of data that's being shared and the mm-hmm. impact that we associate with what we're sharing. So Oracle worked with the CDC to during the pandemic launch a platform called VSafe, and it was tracking adverse events following immunization. And it had 10 million people volunteer to participate and complete surveys on how they were feeling after immunization. And to the point where we collected responses from 35,000 pregnant individuals, and we were actually able to help the government say, okay, the vaccines are safe for pregnant people. And so that is something that's so tangible. People can say, I contributed to that, and I helped analysis and that insight come to being. But I think it's because the CDC was involved. You know, Oracle was very clear about the security measures that were in place to protect information. So I think it's about communication of impact and also how privacy and security are being protected.
That's great. I think actually that's a great segue into coming back to the question that we asked at the very beginning. And I just want to revisit this, if anybody would mind kind of getting their phone out and just giving us a take, having heard this conversation. Where are you guys now at in terms of, you know, this question of would you be willing to share health data? Just curious if anyone is thinking differently about this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
There's a funny piece of that where it's like, without examining the question so much, I think that people can oftentimes imagine that their healthcare data is going to be used to turn, you know, kind of them into, or like create like this evil clone of them and that'll take over the world. So I think some of the fears there are a little funny sometimes.
Yeah. So, okay, I'm going to pause while we let's keep these coming in as we go. There's a whole 10 more questions that we're unfortunately not going to have the time to get to, but I'm going to use chair's prerogative and ask you guys to finalize the conversation and give us a bit of a sense of where you think the future will take us. So if you project out 10 years and think about, you know, where we're going to be in longevity therapy, where we're going to be in personalized health, what does that look like? And if you could give it to us in 3 sentences, challenge on, that would be great. Lucy, do you want to go?
Oh no, first? 3 sentences. Okay,
no pressure.
I'm just most excited about continuous monitoring, and you know, not just through wearables, but through accessories, through clothing, through things that are everyday parts of our lives, through the rooms that we walk into, because I think that's really going to open up the ability for personalized medicine and for early intervention and for prevention. So. Yeah, I think that's where I would go.
Great. Okay, yeah. Martin, over to you.
I can do it in 3 words.
Oh, all right. Let's have it.
Digital health twins. I think, all the things that we've been talking about here will kind of converge in the next sort of 10, 20 years. And we'll get to a position where we have, you know, complete replicas of ourselves in a digital sphere that, you know, has all of our sort of physical attributes or whatever, but also we'll be backed up with our genetic sort of profile behind that. We'll have sort of wearable information, the continual monitoring that Lucy's talking about, constantly fed into it. And there'll just be an in silico version of ourselves that we can, you know, play with, or not play with, but, you know, manipulate and understand and, figure out what we're at risk of and how to treat certain illnesses.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So I agree with all those things, and I'm really excited about those possibilities. And I'll just take this question in a different direction. And I think that one of the kind of futures that I see coming is real health class disparity, in the same way that you have socioeconomic status disparity and other, you know, disparities in society. And I think that what that will really mean is, you know, the stratification of individuals who have really taken charge of their biological age versus, say, their chronological age, and have access to information and therapeutics that other people don't, which doesn't necessarily reflect their socioeconomic status, but really their interest level and involvement in trying to optimize their health and prevent illness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a future for politicians to start to think about as well, right? We see a lot of those trends today. So we are actually pretty much completely at time. So I think we're going to wrap up there and let everyone get on with their evenings. But just wanted to say, first of all, a big thank you to all of you for joining us. It's been really great to have you, and thanks for participating. We are doing a whole ton of work across Oracle, across Stanford, across the Tony Blair Institute on all of these themes. So please do drop us a line. This is the link to get in touch with us, and our information is on South by Social as well. Beyond that, just a big thank you again. And if you wouldn't mind putting your hands together with me and saying thank you to our panel.
Thank you, Jess.
Thanks, everyone.